Welcome to Justin Hawkins Rides Again, the podcast. Today is a special day, a day many of you have been waiting for. For today, I am speaking to Frankie Poulin. Frankie is the bassist in my band The Darkness and one of the most interesting people you will ever meet. I love talking to Frankie about stuff like philosophy, because he often sort of quotes these guys, and I have no idea what he's on about most of the time. And he's always gracious enough to try and educate me. And he does that in this episode. And I think we also talk a little bit about our 30-year relationship and the ups and downs and the tribulations of it. And I don't know, he was just really open and really interesting. So it was a great episode. I have to apologise for the sound in this episode. I made an error when I was setting up the session. I wanted to have two microphones, one on me and one on Frankie. I forgot to engage the one on me, so sometimes I might be a little bit echoey. So the sound isn't as perfect as we usually like it to be, but I hope it's enough for you to get the vibe. Frankie sounds clear as a bell, and the stuff he's saying is just really fab anyway, so I hope you still enjoy it. You can also watch this podcast over on YouTube, and if you want to get special secret updates about my new projects and music and so on, then sign up to my mailing list, and there's a link in the description. For now, though, please, to enjoy. Good day to you, one and all. This is I, Justin Hawkins, and this is an extra special edition of Justin Hawkins Rides Again, the podcast featuring my dear friend and colleague, Frankie Poulin. Just, I haven't got the guitar.
Justin Hawkins Rides Again.
I started off in a harmony and then I did a unison.
Ah, oh, it's amazing. I didn't even think that was possible.
Wouldn't be the first time, would it?
I suppose we should talk about... this is usually a thing about the pitfalls of the music trade.
Yeah.
So we need to talk about what you think have been the pitfalls of the music trade. What do you struggle with? There's things like... in the early days... Because a lot of people always ask me, what's the thing to do to break through in the music trade? So what, in your view, what should young bands be doing now?
It's strange. This is the Baader-Meinhof thing, because no one had ever asked me that question before. Mm-hmm. And then somebody asked me that question two days ago. So that's not quite Baader-Meinhof, because that's in the last 24 hours. Ah. Somebody said that exact same question to me 2 days ago when I did my first ever podcast. And this is my second one.
How did it go?
Well, that was like being at the dentist. This is more like being at the opticians.
Yeah, because it's more illuminating and less painful.
Exactly. Yeah. But to answer your question, I'll try to be honest, okay? The pitfalls in the music industry. Okay, what's the first thing that comes to mind? It was a long time ago, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know something? Everyone trying to take credit is a bit of a pain in the neck, isn't it? Almost being frustrating for you.
Oh, is that that thing that you sometimes say when success has many fathers and failure is an orphan?
Exactly. It gets quite colonial, doesn't it? Mm. People thinking that they've discovered something, annexing different countries. And it goes right-wing politically, doesn't it? And sometimes becomes...
Give me an example of how that works in the music trade.
People is saying they've discovered things.
Yeah.
Just because they happen to be at a gig that you played, not even the first gig, just one of your early gigs, they discovered it, because presumably no one else was smart enough to actually to count. People like that don't count, do they?
So do you think that's just people who are trying to position themselves as tastemakers?
Yeah. It's f***ers, basically.
It's f***ers. Posers. And what do you think about, like... Because I always say that whenever people say to me, oh, what are you supposed to do in the music trade if you want to break through? I always say, you have to find your audience. I honestly think that's really all there is to it. And, you know, now it's, you have social media, which allows you to connect to vast swathes of folk who have a passing, transient interest in the music you're doing, if you're cool enough or you have the cool enough caption.
It's changed a lot, hasn't it?
Yeah, because it used to be... You'd do flyering. Do you remember when we used to do flyering?
you couldn't do this, could you, 20 years ago?
No, I suppose not.
And it could have all been so different.
Yeah. Do you think we would have been more successful or less?
Well, you probably wouldn't have. That's the thing, though. Maybe you wouldn't have hit rock bottom, so you wouldn't have had that to bounce up off. Mm-hmm. You'd have had a different trajectory.
Yeah.
I can't speak too well because we've just been in the cold swim, haven't we?
Yeah.
It sounds like I'm really nervous, but it's actually because I'm shivering. It's still right. My body temperature hasn't quite...
So we've been doing... Normal. We're on a writing session at the moment in Cornwall. And one of the things that we, Frankie and I do, which I think is multifold, the benefits of it, it's bonding for you and I.
For sure.
It's really, really cold in the sea. And we spend as much time in there to get all the blood flowing, and then we start feeling like it stops being cold and it feels like you're burning.
Yeah.
And then we get out and we feel exhilarated, don't we? And
it's a metaphor for something, isn't it?
Is it?
Everything's a metaphor for everything.
Go on, what's that a metaphor for?
Well, I was asking you, because you're good at that.
Okay.
You're the metaphor whisperer. You're the metaphor. No, that doesn't work, does it?
I'm the metaphor whisperer. Okay, I'm going to whisper the metaphor. I think it's a metaphor for...
Falling in love, probably, isn't it? You go in and it's...
No,
it's not.
Oh, my God, that is brilliant.
Yeah, but if you don't jump in the cold, though, do you? It doesn't start off cold.
I think you do. You go
first. What starts off cold and then it burns?
Enough about my sex life? No. The divorce process? No.
It's backwards, isn't it? It's actually love backwards. Going for a swim in freezing cold water, because it's the icy things at the end, and then it becomes...
Is it a coincidence that love backwards is evil, which is the first part of evolution?
Jeez.
Are we going backwards every time we fall in love?
My head's spinning. I can't even think now. It's probably a good thing.
It is a good thing. No, but we do that, and I think we go in... It's probably the most we talk... And me and you are in there, burning, freezing.
That's true. That's probably why.
It's exercise.
Because it's the polarities, isn't it?
Yeah.
It reminds us of 2003.
When our planet shifted, collided. Yeah, north became south and shit became good somehow. Is that what happened?
Yeah.
And you think that's because of the zeitgeist, when we were struggling for such a long time and then... Suddenly everybody realised that we were right and they were mistaken, momentarily. And then they went,
no, I'm not.
Is it like that?
Could be. There's a lot of things to grasp out there, isn't there? Oh, jeez, look, my rings just come on.
What's your favourite thing about being in a band?
Probably this, being able to vibe even the Westwood jewellery.
Yeah, so it's the trappings that you like, isn't it?
This is the...
Yeah.
What's it called again? The animal?
Armadillo. Maybe?
Armadillo, well done. Mm. We were just watching that the other night, weren't we?
Yeah.
Spinal Tap. Armadillo.
Spinal Tap was a huge influence on us, and we used to deny it at the time. I mean, we took a lot of inspiration from the fact that there was a lot of... It played into a lot of things that we find preposterous, but they're also really fun to play with. Yeah. Things like male vanity.
Yeah.
The ludicrous nature of the touring lifestyle anyway. Embracing stuff that goes wrong, which is one of my favourite things to do.
It is, it's one of your favourite things.
What happens when it goes wrong on stage? How do you feel when that happens?
It's great for me, because I can't make the odd mistake. Concentration, sometimes I lose focus, it's so chaotic on stage.
Yeah,
but yeah, I wouldn't imagine there's many lead singers who relish and encourage band members to make mistakes. Who else do you think does that? Could you think of another frontman that does that?
Well, one of the things that I've noticed about the difference between us and a lot of other bands that I think doing something similar is that sometimes you look at bands and then they seem really choreographed, even the sort of ones that are up and coming and exciting. If they're doing anything glam, it feels like you're watching a theatre performance of something like a musical or something. And we never do that. Like, we embrace the chaos. And I think that's actually a bit of what rock and roll actually means, isn't it? It's sort of, it's not, it's got to be rough around the edges, and when things go wrong, that's really part of the charm. I think it's a bit like when the reason why some people watch motor racing is because they're hoping for an accident, and it's that kind
of... That's the best thing about our gigs.
Yeah, I think it always is. And like, there's something memorable happens every time, and it's like... And the other thing I noticed is like, when we rehearse extensively, it doesn't matter how long we spend routining stuff, the first gig we do, it all goes out the window. And often the set changes as well, because we realise that stuff's not working. So it just sort of feels like rehearsing's a waste of time, because you lose a bit of the magic of the spontaneity and the chaos. Mm. And you also, you don't get it right, because unless there's an audience there, you don't know if you're doing it right, do you?
I guess it's important for Dan and I, because you do need that juxtaposition, you know, of the structured backing. The more structured we are, the more kind of chaotic you can be, you know.
Are you my safety net?
The more that you can just fuck things up a little bit.
Yeah. I don't do it on purpose. I just enjoy it. I enjoy it when it happens and things break.
We enjoy it too.
The only time I didn't enjoy it was when we played in Sweden. Do you remember when we played in Sweden? And it was like, I think it was a Sweden rock festival. Extreme playing on the same
terrible
bill.
Crew, I know.
And it was like
so bad for you. I remember that.
It was a bad one because Nuno Bettencourt was watching from the side of the stage.
Is it okay to say we had the worst ever crew we've had that day? The worst.
I don't remember who was working for us, and I'm not even sure if it was really there.
I don't think
anyone
can be watching this, are they?
No, I think Colin was my guitar tech. It wasn't his fault. It's just one of those things that happened. You know, he was a good guitar tech, but it was just to launch into the solo that I was most proud of in the set, and then Nuno watching from the side, and then nothing came out of my guitar.
It was awful.
Fucking furious. And then, remember the record label lady from Sweden came in and said do you remember what she said to her?
I do remember, yeah.
Do you remember what she said, though?
I remember. She certainly grounded all of us, didn't she?
She said something like, yeah, I'm not sure why the album's not doing well. I think maybe because you're too old. That's what she said. But like, brilliant preparation. That was, and then afterwards we had the after show food, and I had a vegan pizza. Yeah. You guys had normal pizzas, I think. Or you had a vegetarian one. I had a vegan one. And your ones were round pizzas with toppings on, the way that you'd expect a pizza to be.
Yeah.
Mine was a slice of bread with some like vegan salami on top of it. I was furious.
It was a tough day, wasn't it?
It was difficult. Yeah, I mean, what's been the most... What do you think's been the toughest... what's the toughest thing about being out on the road?
Was that maybe your ground zero in terms of since the comeback?
Yeah, since we reformed...
Maybe it was.
Yeah. In terms of backstage arrangements and, like, having, you know...
In terms of live experiences, there was probably heavier things, wasn't there? There was heavy things, which will be coming out in the documentary.
Oh, yeah.
Later this year. Yeah. Heavier emotional things to do with family and past members. All that stuff is really draining, really tough. But in terms of the live thing, I can imagine that would be so tough for you, someone like that watching you and then...
Yeah. I mean, we've had those things where, you know, Brian May and Roger Taylor, and we've had, who else have we had watching from the side? That's Jeff Beck, haven't we? We've had a lot of sort of...
It's tough, isn't it? What do you find when...
And it gives you a lift, you know, it makes you perform a bit more.
It always gave you a lift at the times when it... Say there's someone that's influenced you, is that harder?
Yeah, like when Slash is there.
Dan said that, didn't he, about playing in front of Steve Jones in LA when he was doing Concrete.
Yeah.
And you realise that kind of chugging, power chord chugging, he wouldn't be doing that if it wasn't for Steve Jones. Can make you a bit self-conscious, but that's probably the thing that you suffer from the least in terms of...
Yeah, I mean, I just want...
Band members.
Because it's kind of like, I always think it's... You and I spend a lot of time gesticulating towards the crowd, don't we? We always kind of try and connect with certain... sections. We've got our own little tribes, haven't we? And we always sort of try to give them a good time. But I always think that when you know Slash is watching or Jimmy Page is in the audience or something like that, then it just makes you try a bit harder. Because you want them to have a good time. You want
that's it focuses you.
Yeah.
Does.
Because I know it's like when I go to a gig, even as a having experienced, you know, all the stuff that we've experienced, you still go there and you still go, to a degree, you kind of go, impress me, don't you?
Yeah.
And you want to impress everybody, really.
There was a lot of the Hollywood Vampires gig, wasn't there? Lots of people side stage.
Yeah, why was that? How come everybody comes out for those ones? Hollywood Vampires seems to be like...
Johnny Depp effect, doesn't it?
Do you think it's... Yeah. Okay. And probably a bit of the Joe Perry effect as well. And Alice Cooper effect.
Yeah.
What did you think of the Hollywood Vampires? Did you enjoy watching their sets?
I'm not sure. No, I really don't know.
What's the good thing about it?
The thing is, I guess being in the darkness, and then if you say anything that's remotely, it certainly wouldn't be disparaging because those guys are legends.
Yeah.
But just in terms of how much, the thing is, you know, it's a similar territory to the one that we occupy in terms of what the media would say, you know, it's that kind of theatre aspect.
Yeah.
We're more English music halls, aren't we? We're tapping into that, aren't we? Mm-hmm. Whereas Hollywood Vampires probably tapped into, it's almost like a kind of Hollywood musical, isn't it? Like it's strange.
I mean, it seems like a covers band, almost. I mean, there's a couple of originals in there.
Yeah.
It's really well played.
Didn't they start off as a wedding band?
I don't know.
First of all, yeah, I heard that the first gigs were actually at some big cheese's wedding. Mm. And then they thought, hey, we should do this.
What's your... what's the best gig you've ever seen as a punter?
It's a big question.
Mm. Was there one that sticks out as...
As a punter, okay.
Yeah, as a punter.
Okay. I'm going to say 1986 because I was 18 and I was at Glastonbury and I was there. There was two amazing moments. There was the Pogues being really near the front, having a few drinks and just the chaos of it, you know. Mm. Not even being able to hear Shane McGowan's vocals, to be honest, because it was just completely chaotic.
Mm.
But there was something about
Water Boys as well. Were they on the same?
Yeah, that was the same Glastonbury. And the Water Boys had, it was romantic, you know. That's the thing. Yeah, Celtic romanticism.
Yeah.
Both bands, you know. Mike Scott, people think he's Irish, but funny enough, he's from Edinburgh or from the east coast of Scotland, anyway, so, which is where I'm from as well.
But he always had a really cool haircut.
Yeah. And I like his face as well. He's got something. He's like.
His face likes you.
It's quite essential. He's like one of those guys you see in National Portrait Gallery. He's got a period face, I would say.
Really?
You know, you could see him there, couldn't you, with his floppy hat, almost in Shakespearean times.
Mm.
And I like his voice as well. He's an interesting guy, you know. He obviously went quite far down that whole New Age thing, you know. Which I find quite problematic. But in him, at least, I can forgive that.
Hippie bullshit. That's what you
No,
mean.
I can tolerate that side of things when there's a romanticism to it.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
What's the difference then? So hippie, because one of the things that you've said to me,
yeah,
I'm going to quote you on something that's been a lesson that you've tried to drill into me over the years, and I haven't listened to
Trust a hippie.
Never trust a hippie. You said that. You said you had that tattooed on your actual heart.
But you know something? I think I would provide a couple of exceptions to that, just to clarify what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say Americans, where it really came from, I think.
You mean Haight Ashbury and all that sort of
stuff? Yeah, I think that's different. There's a depth to it. America's a different country to Britain and England, shall we say.
Mm.
It's vast, you know, and you can't really mess around if you're a hippie there. It's like, you know, you're getting your hands dirty. You have to kind of, you know, the American way, you know, it's less hospitable terrain. Whereas England has that quay twain thing, you know, And there's also that a class thing. It comes back to politics as well. Has there ever been a working class hippie? In terms of in England, you know?
My mum and dad nearly were, I think. And they're definitely working class, but it's... But only in the sense that they... Because, I don't know, hippie is such a broad term, isn't it? It's like...
It's okay if you buy into it, you know, if you've earned the right and you've done it. I'm talking about young people. There's a tendency where it's... I hope I'm not going to ostracize a lot of fans. But no, okay.
Of course you won't. You're allowed to have opinions.
This is ruminating, isn't it? This is what this is for, isn't it?
To ruminate. Yeah. I need to ruminate on this. But it's something you've always said, never trust a hippie. And I think the context that you used to say that to me in... that was actually like the first example of you taking me under your wing when I first moved to London, when I first met you.
Wow, I was even saying it back then.
You were saying it back then.
Jeez, and it was about
I think we were in the context of talking about one particular guy that was in our group of friends, you know, who was, you know, used to say man a lot, and he was definitely a hippie. I'm not going to say who it was, but... He's the kind of bloke where he'd borrow your last fiver and then you wouldn't see him for a couple of months and you'd be, you know, waiting for your gyro to come in and then this guy's just disappeared. Yeah.
Well, you know, the thing is they always get bailed out by their dads, don't they?
Right.
And okay, like I say, so, I'm clarifying this from talking about the English, and I'm not talking about women because I think women actually suit that thing quite a lot because it's more of a nurturing...
Yeah.
You know, the female hippies, there's something, you know, it's a different thing. Psychologically, it's a different space than habit, but the men and the English ones, it's almost invariably coming from middle class background, and they mess around for a few years doing it, and then they get bailed out by the dad, and then end up working for the dad's company. Yeah, it happens a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess so.
And also, when I used to say that to you, I used to sometimes say, if I ever have a daughter, I will tell her that, you know, because it's the those nice women that are sideballed.
But at the same time, what did you do in university? You did philosophy, didn't you?
No, I was only there for like a year. I was studying history and English literature in Bath University, and then I dropped out.
To be a rock star.
Yeah. No, take acid. You know, it was... like I say, it was that Glastonbury, you know, 86, and there was like a thing going on, you know, and it felt, there was something in the air, you know, and the alternative music then and the alternative culture as well.
Mm.
And I read...
so do you think that's like the 80s is a golden age for like the emergence of that kind of indie stuff?
Well, that's when idealism died, I think. At some period in the 80s, early 80s, it was still kind of there. And then mid 80s in the UK, I think it was stamped out by a lot of Margaret Thatcher's kind of philosophies and policies, amongst other things.
Mm.
It wasn't just there.
when we first met, we were all skint. And you... were always the most generous person I could ever... you're the most generous person I met in London in that time. And it was always like if you had a fiver and it was enough to buy two pints, you'd buy us two pints. You know what I mean? You'd always share that.
That's something I think...
And you'd do that, and it would be like an understanding that... I used to tease you by saying thank you for the gift of this pint,
we used to tease each other a lot about that kind of thing. I guess I was probably doing it just to put an end to all the Scottish jokes, you know?
That's it, you reacted.
But also I think the fact that you recognise that, I think people tend to project, don't they? I think you're actually a very generous guy, so people almost recognise the things that they have in themselves.
Maybe I'd like to think so. But we didn't really have anything, did we, in those days?
Didn't have much.
Do you remember when did you... we were doing a band before The Darkness, weren't we, in the 90s? I mean, I felt like I was a peripheral character in that because I was only playing a bit of keyboards and saying stuff in between the songs. But really, it was you and Dan's project, wasn't it, with Steve Sargent? And
you were the only one that had any stage presence. even on the back of the stage, sit behind the keyboard. You'd be cracking gags and in quite a compassionate way, because the singer would be faltering slightly.
Hmm.
He had a great voice, and he could hold down a tune really well.
He was really good in the studio as well. He was a great live singer. And
but to be honest, it wasn't just him. Dan, the singer, myself, we struggled a bit, but you came alive on stage.
I was always tucked away in the corner, so it's kind of...
Do you think it's an extrovert thing? Do you think it's... I mean, you can never really boil something down to one thing, but I guess that's the best way of looking at it.
No, I think what it is like, for me, it's when I'm in a situation like that one, it's a little bit like sometimes if we're in an interview... Years ago, when we used to do interviews and we'd all be hungover, and then somebody would ask the most mundane question... And then we'd all just sort of like sit there like this, and then I'd look around at everyone and go, oh fuck, somebody better say something, you know? So I always had that kind of, I don't know, a sense of somebody's got to say something or do something.
You know? Oh yeah, yeah.
It was like that, really. I didn't want to necessarily. It wasn't like a compulsion.
You don't think it's the fact that you're energized by having lots of people looking at you or lots of people in the room. You're energized?
Difficult question. I don't know, because
it can be a simple
no, because sometimes it's like
because it depends we're on talking, people, doesn't it?
Yeah,
you suddenly went energized when the Disturbed fans were there, weren't you?
But I was,
oh, yeah,
I really went for it that day. I was just
that's because you're a contrarian,
yeah, an energized contrarian.
It's funny because we often look at things in different ways, but I often think that's one of the few things we have in common, fundamental things, is that we're both contrarians,
yeah. Mm-hmm. No,
but different types of contrarians. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So, does anything make sense? I mean, it's like...
Well, maybe different things trigger the contrarianism in each of us. That sounds a bit complicated. Maybe I'm just overcomplicating this.
I feel like that... Well, I mean, that the Disturbed gig you're talking about, and David Drayman, did you hear that? Like,
what, is he the singer?
Yeah, he's the singer from Disturbed. And,
yeah.
And so, like, I think one of the questions I had on one of my comments days was, what was the worst audience reaction you ever had? And I said, well, it was that Disturbed gig. It was awful. You know, they were throwing loads of stuff. It was really angry. Yeah. And I might have said something disparaging towards the Disturbed crowd, because they didn't fucking like me. Why would I bother pretending to like them, you know? And then David Drayman actually tweeted or Instagrammed at me saying, I'm really sorry that you had that experience, maybe we can get a beer sometime. It was so awesome. It's really nice.
Changed so much, haven't they?
Yeah, but I mean, it's sort of, but I think that it's probably always been like that in America, and I always think that there's a sort of jealous band bitching interband, or you know,
well, the toxicity of the British music scene with all the interband thing, that was really fired up by the Enemy, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Enemy and Melody Maker used to love all that.
Yeah.
And it's funny because a lot of those journalists from those magazines now are kind of struggling now, aren't they? Mm. And there is a...
So. I don't know who you're talking about. Who's struggling? What do you mean? They're struggling for work? Or I mean, that's for everybody's struggling, aren't they? This internet's killed everything.
Yeah, I don't want to knock people when they're down.
Yeah.
Or maybe a day.
Well, maybe they... I mean, I don't have that much sympathy for Enemy journalists, because like I feel like when we were sort of coming up...
But let bygones be
bygones. Yeah, absolutely. I'm all for that. But I just think that, like, you know, when we were emerging, there was another band called the Datsuns, which was like... remember those guys? They're like a New Zealand-based... Or New Zealand... they came from New Zealand, right?
Yeah.
And they were doing something along the lines of what we were doing. That's more in the AC/DC realm, not as much Queen, but they were sort of in the same... People would probably categorise them in the same way that they did us at the time. And the Enemy were just like, they wanted them to win. They didn't want to see a scene of that kind of rock coming back.
Yeah.
They wanted the Datsuns to be the band, and they wanted us to fuck off. And there was one journalist that wrote that I should be killed and replaced with some real music. And I was like, you know, that's not a very nice thing for my mum to be, you know, like, you think about, like, when stuff comes up, you know, yeah. and your parents are excited about it, they're making scrapbooks, and then they see something like that, it's like...
But you know something, the issue is just the fact that their knowledge and the calls they make are actually not educated ones. For example, the one saying that Andrew WK, who was one of their darlings as well, who they were desperate to be big, weren't they? They said that we stole his shtick.
I've never seen this. I don't know what his shtick is.
Exactly, but Enemy said that we stole his shtick, and they said
because we like having parties.
Yeah, they made comments about the Datsuns were like Led Zeppelin, and we were kind of, you know, the AC/DC side, and they've always had it in AC/DC because they see that as kind of toxic masculinity.
Mm.
I remember they once said, there was an Enemy journalist who said that it was AC/DC, it was like music for rapists, or words to that effect.
Jeez.
Which is really nasty, strong. Kind of... it's fucking bullshit.
Yeah, it is bullshit. Else.
But that's what I mean, it's just, they're so wide of the mark, you know?
Mm.
Anyway, why are we wasting our time talking about...
I don't know, actually.
Fuck them.
Yeah, fuck them. What was the nearest when you were coming? When you were like, because you were in London for a bit longer than me. When did you move to London?
Mid-90s.
Okay, so I came like towards the end of the '90s, really.
Yeah.
Yeah,
maybe 97. Oh, of course.
No,
yeah.
I was there at 97.
So Dan and I used to visit. Yeah, the band that Dan and I were in before Empire. I was in a band with him before I was in a band with you. And we went for a songwriting weekend to Lowestoft, staying at your folks' place.
Yeah, you came to Goldstone.
And the first time I saw you, I think you were playing football with these kids.
Yeah.
And I just remembered when you were celebrating the goals, you just had this huge smile. But, and I'm not saying this to be cheesy, but it was just like such a innocent smile, but just like joyful. It was such a joyful smile.
There's nothing better than playing football, though. I've always said
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah, you were having such fun doing it. You're playing these younger kids, and you were just having, you just looked incredibly free, and you know, you had a real positive energy. Everyone knows.
Let's clarify. The kids weren't. They were not talking about 10-year-olds or anything. It was like, when you say kids, you mean people in their early 20s, like.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I used to play every Sunday. You must have come down for a rehearsal or something like that, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And you played
it's a songwriting weekend.
Yeah.
Which I guess indicates that the band was relatively advanced, but I think we were just pretentious, and we just...
Nothing wrong with that, though.
Nothing wrong with
You've
it.
Got to be pretentious, haven't you? Because the things that we like...
I'm probably the most pretentious in the band. I'm the bass player, Spinal Tap, you know. Mm. I mean, I'm half French, you know, so it's a given, you know. A half French guy is going to be more pretentious than a couple of guys from Lowestoft, yeah, every time, yeah.
I don't know, though.
Really? I always thought that you guys thought that often when you find me a bit annoying or excruciating, it's like normally because I'm being a bit pretentious.
That's... No, I think sometimes it's like, what's frustrating...
Actually, you know,
I don't know whether it's appropriate to get into this.
No. It's not appropriate, but I just want to say one thing. I know what it is, because the thing is, it's the same things when I look at my, say, a brother of mine or a parent of mine. I can see that. And the same thing that I find exasperating. I'm old enough now where I think, of course, that's what the people find exasperating in me. It's,
no,
it's very simple.
You know what? There was a period of time when... I was so into what we were doing and like living it. Do you know what I mean? Like I was just like, I changed a lot, and I know I changed in some good ways and some really terrible ways as well, just from, you know, never switching off.
Yeah.
And we talk about this a bit in some, like, as one of the pitfalls, you know, because it changes your, if you do it in a way that's authentic and rings authentic, then you're doing it when you're on stage and you're doing it when you're off stage, and you're the same person. It's just, obviously there's some slight exaggerations in the way you gesticulate when you're yeah. playing live, but you've got to change who you are to really sell that, because it's such a fucking crazy, it's a ridiculous thing that we're trying to convince people that we are, you know.
Mm.
So I know I changed, and then I felt like there was a period of time when I felt like we weren't on the same page, and I didn't expect
2004.
I'm not really sure what I'm talking about. I think it's something that's sort of day, yeah. and I know it's not you. It's actually my. I just get lonely sometimes when I'm out on the.
Curse.
When I'm out there trying to do it all, and you know, I'm just like fucking. This is it. Yeah, we're fucking. This is the great. Yeah. And then I get up on the bus, fucking hungover. And you're already out at an art gallery or something like that. You know, that was frustrating because we couldn't hang and grow in the same way. I kind of felt like...
What were we talking about in that period, though?
I think we're talking about...
Or after the Reformation.
I think the Reformation, we were all sort of gingerly trying to protect something that we knew was important. And
it was a tough time, actually, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was difficult.
Also,
I think it took,
you know, wasn't necessarily our best... albums.
No, it wasn't. But that's
of course,
because we weren't
sadly, the way the band was managed and the running of the band, there was a lot of issues, wasn't there?
There was, but I think that there was a sort of... That was a good example of us going away for 5 years, and then when we come back, like, the whole industry's completely changed.
Yeah,
and then we had that whole thing of, like... Because, you know, our first record, and to a lesser degree, the second record, and all of the sort of existence around it, there was actually mystique. You know, there wasn't
Mystique.
Things like... Yeah, there wasn't content, you know. Yeah. We weren't obliged to show people what it's like when we go for a shit or whatever it is people put on social media. But there was no... All people saw was the videos that we did, you know, the interviews that we did, the gigs that we did.
Mm.
And everything else was sort of... Just was mythological, really, wasn't it? It was kind of like people sort of euphemistically talking about their experiences at our after shows or our launch parties and stuff. And we had this kind of thing that I thought slipped away from us, where we were properly like four snotty wankers just coming in and not giving a fuck and just doing our stuff, and we weren't playing anything that was fashionable.
It felt good to hear that. For some reason, when you said four snotty wankers...
Yeah, that's who we were, remember?
That's like... It really resonates.
It's what you want to be, isn't it?
It's like we'd known that at the time.
Exactly, and I felt like I did know it, and I could see it disappearing, and I was like, and I was trying to pull us in like a really destructive direction, and you were probably protecting yourself, and I know what happens like after a period of time, you've got like, I think you have four people. And it's a work thing and it's a gang thing, but gradually you go off and you have like your own lives, don't you? And you have like you've got a family or you become a father or just other, you know, business interests and other projects and things like that. And you lose that sort of connection.
Yeah.
And it's really frustrating because that it is the thing that I'm most fond of, is the stuff when we were first coming up. And we were like, fuck you guys, isn't it?
Nice,
fuck all this shit, you know, it was all bullshit. We just totally called it, you know, all the time. We were pretty punk rock, you know, and we lost that a little bit. And that's what was frustrating for me, I think.
It was, wasn't it? When you look back at us just kind of shitting it out, you know, like even on the TV shows.
Yeah.
Like, we were really kind of, we didn't compromise. We weren't really aware of the surroundings. We were just this... kind of unit. When you see some of those American TV shows, we just got so much attitude, you know.
I mean, that thing about jumping off, when I jumped off Jules Holland's piano, that was your idea.
Well, thanks.
And you said to me, and you actually took me to one side, and you did that one anyway. You know, you should get up on his piano and do the solo. You know what I mean?
But can I tell you something? The most popular comment on that video on YouTube is when the singer leaves the bassist hanging, because I went to give you a high five. After that, after you said that, thanks for saying it. And then of course I don't blame you.
I mean, I was fucking
because
pumped.
Of course you were fucking pumped. So
I was
course
really
you didn't
pumped.
See me. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You don't always see the
of course.
Palm.
Yeah, exactly. Of course, and I didn't take like that at the time either. Just because some people see it like that on YouTube, because of shit, you know.
I always think about the sort of urban gesticulation and the natty abbreviation of the handshake. The high five, it's like the coolest one is, you know, in Purple Rain, the movie, I mean, when the time of doing it, and is it Morris? What is his name? Morris?
Morris Day.
Yeah, and he goes like, somebody bring me a mirror. And then someone brings up, his mate brings up a mirror. And they do a little, they do a high five that's sort of conducted down there. It's a really cool one. I'm going to make it up to you now. This one. You don't even look.
Oh, yeah,
you
know, I like it.
Back up, you know what I mean?
So I like it, I like it.
What are we doing? This is the whitest. Maybe.
But this is an example of why white guys should never try and do that.
Yeah, never abbreviate the...
But I appreciate the sentiment. Yeah. But again, that's the whitest thing. That's why people...
Imagine, high five, I appreciate the sentiment.
White people do it awkwardly and then they appreciate the sentiment.
I love the sentiment of the high five.
Roger Moore, do you think he ever high-fived someone?
Cool, that's a good question.
Probably Pussy Galore.
Yeah.
Mind you, would you... No, you wouldn't high-five someone you just had a romantic liaison with, would you? That's like a bit dude-ish, isn't it?
Yeah.
I've talked to girls before and they say that what they can't stand is when a guy calls them dude, like a guy that they're romantic about.
You ever done that?
I remember this girl was showing me this message. No, she was talking about like a guy that she'd been with, you know, and she'd been involved with a few years previously, you know, and then said that she went off him because he called her dude.
You've got to be so careful with the language you use nowadays, isn't it?
You do, yeah.
So what about when you're on tour and do you find... I'll give you my perspective of touring. It's the only time in my life when I have any routine in my day. I know what's going to happen.
Are we moving away from emotions?
No, I think we should probably...
Because I was thinking about the thing about men when they get uncomfortable about emotions, they always bring it back to numbers and kind of dimensions. You know?
Yeah.
Like when somebody mentions that there's a baby's been born and the women are all saying, oh, that's lovely, all hugs. And, how do you feel? And then the men are just... really uncomfortable. And
how heavy was it?
How many months? You know, how much was the baby?
How many months? It's usually going to be 9. That's going to be the answer. Was it the full 9 months? Yeah, nice.
You always have to quantify.
How many legs have you got? 2. Yeah, perfect. Yeah, mine too.
Emotional crisis. It's numbers. But anyway, carry on.
Oh, yeah.
No, we can carry on.
Why do you do that then? So. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think that's sort of like how your income is sort of intrinsic to your self-perception as well and all that sort of stuff? Do you think it plays into that?
Well, it's destroying the planet, isn't it? Because it's the economic growth, GDP, all that kind of thing. Numbers, figures. So the media say it's up or it's down. And if it's down, then you've got to do even more fracking and all that kind of stuff. So it's destroying the planet. Just man's obsession with numbers.
Yeah.
Targets. Which is basically just the sperm thing, isn't it? It's just sperm
and egg. Well, isn't it invented anyway?
Somebody said that about football. It's probably some Guardian journalist, but something about putting the ball in the net is just basically this, you know, the sperm and the egg, basically. It's a little bit simplistic, though, isn't it? I mean, if you simplify everything in life like that,
no, but it's not even the get same out of as bed. That, because otherwise there'd be a goal, there'd be 5 million balls flying towards the goal, and only one of them can go in.
I know, but I guess in a way, it's if you slow down time and just had them all, you know, those chats.
Yeah, and then what would happen? Then there'd be a whole new pitch would grow from that goal which has got the ball in it. What's that? I don't understand that metaphor. That doesn't work.
Again, it's one of these things. It's one of these ways of simplifying things down. It's the same kind of people that say that Jaws, the movie, is basically a vagina with teeth. You know, it's like the sexual...
Nobody's ever said that to me.
It's the Freudian analysis.
So what the fuck is the Meg, then?
It's the Freudian analysis of things. You know, if you do, it's like reductionism, you know, deconstructing
things. Why does it have to be a vagina?
It's a pain in the ass. I used to do it too, deconstruct things. And I thought, what the fuck's the point in deconstructing it?
So when somebody said to you, construct Jaws... Please.
Songs.
Yeah, creativity.
Exactly. That's my problem. I deconstruct too much.
You know, like in an era when everything seems to be content and very little of it seems to be art, do you think we should be more careful about who we allow to label themselves creative?
Good point, yeah.
Do you think, like, do you get pissed off with bloggers and stuff like that calling themselves creatives?
Maybe not, though. Because there is that element of... Oscar Wilde had answers for all the art questions, didn't he? He said, a truth in art is only that is contradictory is also true.
Why, you have to run that past me again.
Well, a truth in art is only that whose contradictory is also true in the realm of art.
Ah, okay. So,
and it makes me think of you.
So if you write a song and then you say, I don't love you, then it also means I love you. Is that what you mean?
Well, I would take it in regards to you, like your aesthetic, where something is so kind of like bad or, oh, that's fucking terrible, but it's also fucking brilliant.
That's my favourite.
That's the best way of summing up that Oscar Wilde quote.
Okay.
And I do think that that's an aesthetic.
Oh, do you mean because it's subjective? Is that what you mean by something? Because
it's the fact that there are no moral kind of boundaries for a start, but also moral guidelines. It's not a case of good and bad. It's just a case of it's art. Yeah, you know, where judgments don't apply, you know, or they shouldn't apply. You know, they shouldn't matter. Judgments don't matter.
So what's the point of journalists then?
Exactly.
I guess that's it's creating like a high watermark. You know, it's in the, a good journalist should have an understanding of classical education in a way, to have some grounding, you know, where they understand a little bit about the Greeks or the Romans and the standards, and a lot of things came from Greece, didn't it? You know, theatre, philosophy.
Can I do one thing with you?
Yeah, of course can.
You know how sometimes you give instant reactions to videos?
Yeah.
I want you to give an instant reaction to a quote, yeah?
Okay, go on.
Okay. First I'll just tell you the quote and then we can say who it was. I only read it for the first time, I think, day before yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Whatever happens to you has been waiting to happen since the dawn of time. It's by a guy called Marcus Aurelius. It's quite powerful, isn't it?
Shit. Shit. Okay. What does that mean then? Has it
exactly?
Okay, so when he says that, is he saying that like there's a timeline to it as well, and it's determined to happen, or it's just like these events, or micro events, or anything? Like you're talking about things like a fly landing on your shoulder, or something like that. Or is it everything?
Well, I don't know, because I haven't really looked at the context of it or anything. I know it's the Stoics, yeah?
Yeah.
Stoicism.
Yeah.
But I think it plays into a lot of things. Like you could say it plays into multiverse theory, which you've talked about a little bit, and also to the fact that time's a human mind construct as well.
That's a Prince quote, isn't it?
Maybe the Stoics were into that, you know?
Was it Prince that likes that?
Yeah, I think quite a few people have said about Prince. He's probably the coolest guy that ever said it.
Yeah, he probably is, actually.
Yeah. I guess if a scientist says it, no one really pays any attention.
Yeah, when Prince says it, it's like, yeah, well, it must be true then. What's your favourite Prince album?
It's a great quote, though, isn't it?
It is great. It's great, but it makes me think...
I almost couldn't even say it because it was so heavy. My stammer almost came back, you know?
Yeah. It's such a huge
statement. It's too big to talk about, isn't it?
God, it's enormous. So...
It is big, isn't it? It's huge.
Why is it so big?
I don't think I've heard that. Why is it so big?
It doesn't know why it's so big.
Why is it so big?
It's frightened. It doesn't know why it's so big.
The Stoics are quite in fashion.
Okay, so the Stoics, I always thought Stoicism were people who just sort of steadfastly, without any emotion, just confronted whatever it was that life threw at them and never sort of impulsively reacted. Is that what Stoicism is, or is that something completely different? And how does it relate to music?
Okay, now we're talking. That's all we can talk about, isn't it? Mm. We're musicians.
Yeah.
We're not philosophers.
So in the music existence, how does Stoicism...
Hey, maybe we're Stoics without even realising it.
I feel like we might be because, you know, because I think a lot of people, and like people that we know, have had musical journeys of their own, and at some point it gets to the point where it's unbearable. They're too invested in the idea of success, so that when that doesn't happen, they're not ready to sort of stoically accept that and plow through that. They give up and they go and do something else, don't they? Mm-hmm. Or they pivot, or they just abandon that dream.
Yeah.
In the name of...
pussies.
I don't know.
In the name of being a pussy?
Being a giant pussy, that is it. But it's also kind of like... so that they can experience success in some area, you know. I've got a little cousin who, you know, Connor Adams.
Yeah.
He's a lovely boy. He used to play rugby at quite a high level. Like he was, you know, playing for England in an age group above the one he was, because he was huge and he was really
quite
good.
He's quite brawny, isn't he?
Yeah, he's just a really good... he's well built for rugby and he's talented and all that. But I think he heard some music, probably, he might have been Ed Sheeran or something like that, and it just changed his whole life. And now chases that, abandoning like the opportunities that he had to be a professional sports person, because music is the thing that he loves.
Yeah.
Now, what is that? What
are we still talking about Aurelius? How it relates to that? Everything relates to that Aurelius quote. You can't get away from it, can you? It haunts you. It's going to keep you awake tonight, isn't it?
Oh, it is, yeah.
But Connor, yeah. Nice guy, yeah.
I mean, I just think... I admire stuff like that. And that's actually what people used to see in us. Do you remember when we did the first... the first sort of national press thing we had that was important was the Dazed and Confused thing, which was a fashion magazine.
Yeah.
And their whole thing about us was, here's a band that is making really unfashionable music. They're never going to make it. And yet they plow on. And that was the thing that they admired, wasn't it? Sort of like just stoically brushing off all of the disappointment of not being able to do music to the kind of audiences that we felt like our music deserved. And we were just carrying on.
Yeah.
And they were just like...
oh, yeah, stoicism. Yeah.
Is that stoicism?
I think it has aspects of it, yeah. It's hard to talk about yourself, isn't it, in your own context?
Yeah. So if you had a philosophy then, what's your philosophy? Because I know that you're well versed in a lot of these things.
Well,
do you
really
pick and choose bits?
I'm not really, yeah. I just pick and choose. Mm. I was quite proud though that I encouraged you to put Nietzsche reference in
Mighty Wings.
I'm not mine, I'm dynamite in Mighty Wings.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't really understand why I was saying it, but I thought, well, if Frankie thinks it's cool, I'll do it.
But those giant philosophy books, very few people have actually read either or by Kierkegaard. It's enormous, you know. And the lettering is quite small. Look at that, I'm still shivering. Not from nerves because of doing a fucking podcast like this, but because of swimming in the freezing cold water. You'll back me up here.
It's fucking freezing.
It's not because I'm nervous, is it?
No, you're not nervous. Have a look at this thing still going. Yeah, good.
But anyway, philosophy... yeah, you can't, as soon as you start a conversation talking about philosophy, it just sounds stupid. Because it's life, it's school of life, isn't it?
Yeah, but I don't know, it's weird because it's like, I think, what does philosophy do? It helps, it equips you for the challenges and
but
the tribulations.
But you know something, Ricky Gervais, there'd be no office if Ricky Gervais hadn't studied philosophy.
Mm.
And he's gone on record and talked about that. Yeah. It gives you a certain amount of self-awareness. It gives you context. And it also gives you this thing, which I think is very important in life. And I've boiled it down to one kind of phrase, which is when people talk about things and the troubles that they're having, I always say, or when they try to understand something, I say, everyone zones in.
Mm.
Don't zone in, zone out.
Mm.
And that's why people become stoners or do mushrooms. Because it's a way of zoning out. And that's what happens with age, you know. Rather than like this, although paradoxically your spine is more like this when you're older, but but spiritually and cosmically you're actually more like this, hopefully, if you've... the mixture of experience, books, everything, and emotional experiences you've had, and mistakes you've made. It comes from mistakes, doesn't it?
Mm.
And we certainly as a band
coming back to the band. That's one thing that I love about this band is we're not afraid to make mistakes. Mm. Most of what we do is actually mistakes. If you think about the albums, you know, you know, when you look back 10 years later, most of the album is a mistake, but often a glorious mistake. Yeah. And there's a guy I'll just finish talking about philosophy now by talking about one guy, which might make you laugh, actually. It's a guy called Emil Cioran, C-I-O-R-A-N. He was a Romanian guy, and his philosophy was the philosophy of failure. He believed that 99.9% of what humans do ends in failure. And if you actually think about it,
clinically, he's being generous.
Yeah, if you think about it clinically, it's actually true.
Yeah.
But he was also talking from the perspective of being a Romanian. And to him, Romania was the country that embodied that more than any other country in Europe and possibly in the world. Because if you look at Romania, for a start, the gypsies are extremely discriminated against. And it's not talked about nearly as much as other
minorities,
sectors of society. Yeah. But anyway, so Emil Cioran was talking as a Romanian. But there's also something quite funny about his philosophy. Because he's extremely dry, he has the most incredible hair. You know, like Nietzsche has the most amazing moustache, that huge walrus moustache. Emil Cioran has like David Lynch hair, like thick, swept back hair, and a great face that just never moves, never smiles, and huge, big, bushy eyebrows. And he only talks in aphorisms. All of his philosophies, he's two. I think an aphorism is a two-line thing where, you know, the first line posits something and the second one kind of poetically resonates with it or answers the first line. So it's all aphorisms and based around the variation of the fact that everything is failure. But it's actually quite liberating to have that as a starting point, isn't it? A starting point of just thinking if everything's fact. That's why everyone talks about positive thinking, but I think, you know, the power of negative thinking is something that people don't
talk you've always
about.
Done that, actually.
It's a great starting point.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, if you don't understand the reasoning behind that, it can seem like a really pessimistic view. But sometimes you do a thing where you predict the worst-case scenario.
I know it pisses you off sometimes.
Because
I do it before we get on stage.
Yeah. But there was a time when that would be frustrating for me, but now it's kind of like I look forward to it because I know where it's coming from now.
Yeah, I'm not.
You know, it's taken a long time for us to sort of understand each other a bit, really. But
it's true.
Yeah, but it's so funny because I always think about longevity of bands and like if a band like us with the different sort of personalities that we've got and all that sort of stuff, and if we had done like one record and then just never spoken to each other again, we would never have got to the point where we understood.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. We'd never understand each other.
It makes you think why it happened as well.
Yeah,
it's a journey of discovery, and it's certainly a test with all of us because we're all so different.
Yeah,
to anyone outside, I don't want to sound cheesy here, American schmaltzy, but the way you and Dan are with each other is so inspiring and such a template for an example of sibling. Or just family members just getting on, you know. It's really inspiring because you're so different. But really, it's just your good qualities enable you to be incredibly tolerant.
But, you know, it's
starts with tolerance and understanding and compassion. It's all the good stuff.
The other thing that used to cause all of us, and I'm not just talking about me and you, like the stuff that was creating friction between me and my brother and you and my brother and all that stuff,
yeah,
it all comes from the same thing, which also took a little while for us to recognise, and that was the fact that we all loved the project and cared so much about it and was trying to pull it in the direction that we thought it should go in.
Yeah.
And we were all right and all wrong at the same time.
Yeah.
And we didn't really understand what collaboration is.
Yeah.
You know? Because I still get it now. Like on the last record, there was a song on the last record, and I was like, "Yeah, this is the single, guys. This is the fucking single. This is amazing."
Yeah.
And I was just getting like, "Yeah," for everybody, management, you, Dan, everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, "I don't understand this." And because I still get really passionate about stuff like that, I was like, am I even collaborating with people that have the same artistic vision as me? And that's not the point.
Yeah.
That's not why you collaborate.
Yeah.
If we did, we'd be the shittest band alive.
Yeah.
It would just be like...
It's great when Dan says that, when he knows that a song is really cooking and really good, when we all start fighting.
Yeah.
Fighting the battles for what we think the song should be. It's always a good sign.
And you've suggested things in the past that I think is more like the Queen model, where like a song that we're all, that is contentious because there's things in it that we all love that we want to explore more.
Yeah.
You always say one person should be elected the custodian of that song's destiny and sort of, you know, direct the rest of us to their will. And usually the person that you suggest for those things is the one that cares about the song the most. Yeah. But it doesn't always help, because sometimes we all just love it for totally different reasons.
Of course. I've made so many mistakes, and you know, but I think we all have. We've all made mistakes like that emotionally, but the thing is, we're all aware of that now, and that's why it's a great time for the band, because we've all become more self-aware, you know. Thank God.
Yeah.
And especially you, I think, because you've actually gone such a long time without having a drink, and every year, I just want to say one thing, it is really inspirational to see, but the reason is because, if it, just to simplify it, it's lightness. It's when people have therapy or give up booze or do both things in unison, there's a lightness to them. They just become lighter and lighter.
Mm.
And over the years, you become lighter and lighter since you stopped drinking. And I look at that quite, it's inspiring, but also almost like a bit jealous too. And it almost kicks, well, it kicks my own ass, because I would like to have that lightness too.
Yeah, but it's, I always, I feel that, you know, and other people have said it to me as well. Like, so if somebody hasn't seen me for a long time,
yeah,
and then they see me and it's like, fuck, you're much lighter now.
Yeah.
And sometimes I notice it myself. But what happens is I invariably put myself in situations where I'm piling stuff on, you know, like workload, emotional.
Oh, that's a good point you made, though, because you can only take on all that thing if you have that lightness, because if you have the heaviness, then you become avoidant.
Capacity for it.
Yeah, you become avoidant. And I'm aware of that side to myself, and it's something that I'm working on a lot, actually, over the last 2 years. It's gone all American, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, a bit hippie-ish as well. But it's...
I'll hold my hands up.
Yeah, but I mean, when it's like in a, because this week we're writing songs.
Maybe that's what I'm doing. I'm just doing that thing. I'm just criticizing something in myself.
Oh, you're projecting.
Of course I am. I'm projecting. It's always projecting, isn't it?
Is it?
I'm glad I'm able to tell people that. I hope you keep this bit in.
Yeah, I reckon.
Because otherwise, really, I think I might look like a bit of a.
No, we're not going to make you look like.
But really, it comes back to Johnny Rotten, you know.
Yeah.
Johnny Rotten was the first guy to call out Jimmy Savile.
Mm.
We all know about that. A lot of people have seen that clip on YouTube,
mm-hmm.
on that local radio clip. And the punks, even if you know, it doesn't really matter what you think of the music.
But because
the
punk isn't nihilism.
No,
it isn't.
I would say nihilism can be a flavouring to punk, like a little kind of savoury accomplishment, but it's not the foundation for it. I agree.
Because it's like, it's more like activism or something like that, isn't it? It's sort of, there used to be a kid at my school, I think his name was Barry, and he was like, I want anarchy, I just want anarchy, I don't want a job, I just want to sign on. And I'm like, well, if there's anarchy, there won't be a welfare state. You can't sign on if there's anarchy. There won't be any fucking money. What are you going to do?
That's true.
You know, and there was a lot of sort of, I'm not sure if everybody really understood what punk is actually politically, where it sits, you know.
Yeah.
But really, it's just like, the when I say nihilism, I never mean it in a negative way. I just mean,
it's the legacy.
You have a disregard for a lot of the structures that you know.
Yeah. But the legacy is incredible, isn't it?
Mm.
And, you know, you don't have to like the bands at the time, but just to see the legacy and the people that were part of that small group of people, and just the proportion of them that went on to do something important. You know?
What do you think the difference is between American punk and English punk? And what do you consider to be like the archetypal American punk band and the archetypal English punk band?
The English punk has a flavouring of kind of the music halls, and it has there is a flavouring there's something absurdist about the English punk, and it's probably a bit more political, not with a capital P, and has that situationist thing. This, you know, that French thing where it's, you know, they were just kind of wandering around, and I would say it's slightly more, it's more kind of badass. But that's a bit silly using an American expression.
Not really. Because I know what you mean. I think American punk, if you look at what the music sounds like, for me, American punk, it's always tighter. It's more melodic.
It's also a bit schmaltzy too, because it's got that, you know, the Ramones thing, yes, happier. But that's the thing. There's no sentiment in the English punk, and that's what I like about it. But you know something, it's such a huge difference because a lot of the Clash stuff is actually quite cringy. All that, and also the political side of it doesn't stand up to scrutiny. It's like romanticising a lot of the kind of Marxist guerrilla groups, kind of obscure ones, you know, because it's clever to reference obscure stuff. Mm. And I think a lot of that is quite cringy. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Pistols, I think, really does stand up.
Fucking Sex Pistols.
I love the contradictions of the Sex Pistols, you know, like the major label thing and the and then just bringing in Sid, you know, and that's quite nihilistic, isn't it?
I don't think there's ever been a punk band that can surpass the Sex Pistols. And that's actually one of the records that I was brought up on.
And it's mainly because they slowed everything down. Yeah, because the other punk bands, if there was a graph of the tempo of the songs, that's a lot to do with the producer, isn't it? Chris Hughes? Chris Thomas. Yeah, I always get them mixed up. Sorry, yeah. Which one? It's one of the Chris's.
Thomas, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. But anyway, I'm stupid. I don't care. You know, fuck it. I can't remember. Names are for guys, you know. But I like
but
to tap into the female.
Like the producer when something's like...
I like them women don't care about names. So I love them women don't care about names.
Women, this is something that I've observed about you, Frankie. Gender politics. This is something that you've got like a really, it's a beautifully old-fashioned sort of look at what, and you, often you'll start a sentence and you'll say, men do this, whereas women do that. And you're the only person I know that really goes in hard on that stuff.
Well,
where does that come from?
Well, okay, let me clarify what I was saying there. First of all, what I was trying to say was I love the way that women, when they listen to a piece of music or watch a film, you know, the guy will start kind of getting all nerdy and talking about the different films that these directors done, the names of the films. And often when I'm talking to women, they don't care about that, and they don't really want to, and they almost get embarrassed about the fact that they don't know the names, and that's what I think is like ridiculous.
You
like,
can't observe the same thing. You're right about that.
Yeah, it's the emotional reaction to it, you know, and you know the thing itself. You know, the names is a guy thing. It's like numbers, guys is numbers and names, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
it gets tedious, doesn't it?
I think sometimes I'm a bit like I'm nerdy like that about music, but that's only because I want to know. Like, if I like something, I want to know more about what that person, or, you know, if I know who produced it, then I'll be like, okay, well, then I'm going to look for other stuff that they've done, you know.
Yeah, it's a means to an end. Yeah. But that's the point I was trying to make there, yeah. It was hopefully a constructive and a positive observation.
Well, I don't think anybody came off badly in it. It's just interesting that you always observe those things. Especially in 2023, it's really old.
I know, you can be scared of seeing these things, but there are differences. And of course, you know...
Of course there's differences, Of course there are.
Of course, we're really, you know, one love. And
one love. Right, guys?
Yeah. Never quite figured out how to do that.
Yes.
Why am I doing it right?
I remember once we played a gig in Italy somewhere, and there was someone doing that in the front row. And I didn't understand what he was doing. I thought he was making like a rude gesture.
It took me years to understand what people were doing when they did that.
Yeah.
I was blind to it for some reason. Blind to the...
Yeah, I was offended by it. I thought, these fucking guns, what does that even mean? I thought that was like an Italian thing for something.
Jesus, my asshole isn't that big. Despite what I was up to last night. Jeez.
That's good work.
Wait, though, is that... Will that now be construed as something that was...
No, because it's going to offset your gender politics stuff. It's brilliant.
Okay, good.
Brilliant.
It all comes out in the wash.
We'll, yeah, we'll figure that out. Good. All right. Okay, so we've done some tangential meanderings, which I was hoping for. I want to talk to you about Permission to Land, 20th anniversary.
Okay.
Did you listen to all the extra stuff that's going on those discs? There's like, was it five compact discs and not some too much old shows and stuff?
Not too much of it.
Did you listen to any of it?
Well, you know something, the demos were very fresh in my memory. I just had to listen to the first few bars of the Black Shark demo and I thought, oh yeah, that was just like yesterday.
Yeah, you did exactly the same thing. I didn't bother listening to it.
Yeah, it was so strange. And the live stuff, I just think listening to just the audio without seeing the visuals, I'm not sure about it. Mm. But still buy it, of course.
Yeah, you're going to love it. But Dan did, though, because he sort of said it's really exciting he's impressed with it. But, I mean, it's not properly mixed because it's just like it's the some sort of monitor mix, which makes it more exciting somehow. And then apparently the guy that mastered it did a brilliant job. So are you excited about it coming out? And what do you think about 20 years of that record? What does that record make you...
Again, it's a number. I just think 20...
Yeah,
it's just a bullshit. Number. It's got a fucking zero at the end. What the fuck does that
Who
mean?
Cares? Yeah.
But having said that, we've turned it around and we spent a lot of time the last few days coming up with this stage show.
Yeah.
And we are excited about the tour.
Yeah. Do you remember the tour we did 10 years ago, the 10th anniversary of Permission to Land, when we did all those songs?
Yeah.
And a lot of other stuff that was from other parts of our career. But we did, it was more like an outreach project where we were playing tiny places like Home Firth and all these kind of smaller kind
it's
of...
It's so strange the way that outreach, it was like a fart that wouldn't go away, that word.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't it, why for a start did it...
Linger, so.
Emit from someone's...
I have
back
no
end.
Idea.
And then why
I think it was like, it made it sound a bit like care in the community or something like that,
yeah,
didn't
exactly.
it?
Yeah, exactly. And it sounded like we were, like we were to be pitied.
Like people needed us to bring our music to them because they couldn't be asked to go to a main city.
My God, 10 years later, we're still doing this kind of stuff.
No, we're doing big stuff now. This is, I mean, the tickets have just gone.
Would you have guessed that 10 years later we'd have turned it around like this? In terms of ticket sales and such like.
I never put a time factor on those things.
Oh my God, I've been a guy again. Talking about numbers.
I never do that. I actually, that's my feminine. My femininity doesn't allow me to put a timeline on the sort of various benchmarks that we...
Why are you making a difference between men and women in that?
Ah, because we're totally different from everyone. So there's I feel like... we've always known that there's an undertaking to try and rebuild after 5 years off. We've always known that. And every time, like, we'd get, like, a few, you know, arena shows or whatever, like, we played arenas earlier this year, I always think this is... It's like when your favourite football team gets a new manager and then you get a couple of good results. You think, this is a false dawn. There's something philosophically different about being in a band that does the kind of music we do right now that isn't the zeitgeist, isn't in the charts, and it isn't kind of like fashionable. There's no... We don't have major label backing. We don't have the clout in the machinery behind us to do anything that's big like it used to be.
Mm.
But what's important is that we sort of become a cult band, and even that's growing to a degree, isn't it? But in a much slower way. And I never looked at it as a thing where we were aiming to do, like, to get into those spaces.
Yeah.
Like, if I did have, like, a favourite venue, for example, we're hitting them now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, things like Nottingham Rock City has always been, like, it's one of the best gigs you can do in the country.
Oh, yeah.
Glasgow Barrowlands, I'm so happy that we're back in there. But I've enjoyed every show we've done in Glasgow. Yeah. That's why we wrote that song, Welcome to Glasgow. It's because we just love playing there. It's just a different experience because the audience is... there's no other way to say this better. Yeah. It's just the way it is. Yeah. So we're already sort of doing stuff that makes it rewarding. And then the things that aren't rewarding about it, I suppose, like having children, you just, you put up with those, don't you?
Yeah. I guess in the early part of our career, we were the hare, now we're the tortoise. And it's actually more fun being a tortoise, isn't it?
Well, it is, isn't it?
Yeah. I've had partners who've said that that's my spirit animal, the tortoise. It's the most common ones I've had the last few years, but because no one knows you like a partner. Let's be honest. You know, the observations that...
Nobody knows you full stop.
True. That's because you won't let them.
That is...
apart from
what was that again? That was somebody said.
Apart from your 500,000 YouTube subscribers. You let them, but no one else.
Those guys are allowed in. You guys are allowed in.
My top two spirit animals that I've had exes that has popped up several times have been a tortoise, or the one on the cover of the live album.
The llama. Or the alpaca.
Yeah. So that's the two that I've had the most. How about you? Panther?
No, silkworm.
Really?
Yeah, just a little grub.
Who said, was that afterwards? Was that after the
divorce? No, I think there's something about when I was born that makes me a silk. I've actually forgotten what that
was. Is that to do with Chinese mythology?
It might be, actually.
That's interesting.
Yeah, because of the combination of the, I don't know.
Where do you stand on this thing about silk? Where apparently all of the silkworms. No, but the fact that silk's a lovely thing, and as we get older, both of us appreciate it more. Mm. And I've obviously been telling you about the delights of having a silk pillowcase that I take with me on tour, and I'm not ashamed to say that.
Actually, one of my patrons, by the way, the link to my Patreon is in the. one of my patrons gave me one for my birthday, and it's become my touring pillowcase, but I don't really notice any difference.
Okay, I think if you've got dry curly hair, it's a good thing because there's less friction and so less frizz.
I have oily wavy hair, so it's different.
Really? But we both enjoy the seawater in our hair, don't we?
There's nothing better.
So one question, and this is what I was trying to ask you about the silk aspect. Do you feel guilty about all of the silkworms that die in the production of silk?
Yeah.
Apparently that's a thing.
Well, do they die anyway, or how long are they supposed
to live? Good point.
And they get to do what they love, which is making silk, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I figured. That's their raison d'être, I think. What else
do Although, having said that, if I could, what I normally do is I'll get tencel, which is made from some sort of fibre, like a bamboo-y thing. I don't know whether it's got the
same... So vegans against silk, you think?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'll never catch me buying silk, but I was gifted it by one of the patrons.
Is that why... Yeah. But what do you think of vegan clothes?
Most of my clothes are vegan, aren't they? This is all cotton, tencel, cotton. This is some sort of nylon-y thing.
That excuse me for being ignorant.
Not even a leather belt. Look at this. That's not leather, see?
Oh, wow. Okay, that's a nice belt. Unfortunately, this one is.
It's not a nice belt. It looks like... there might be a little bit of...
I was going through customs in America, actually, the other day, and the guy liked it. What's the point of that? Anyway, who cares what custom guy likes? Jesus.
Okay, I'm going to ask you about clothes because you've brought it out of silk.
Is denim vegan?
Yeah.
That's my...
I think it is, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay,
it's the...
Glad to hear that.
It's made out of cotton, isn't it? It's cotton. Yeah. I mean, I think there's probably... Historically, there's going to be a lot of sort of exploitative practices in harvesting the cotton that you need to make those things, and the sweatshops and all that stuff too. But, I mean, in essence...
Yeah.
I think it can be vegan, yeah. But anyway, I was talking about clothes. You are the most stylish member of the band. There was no question about
that. Not true. People say that.
And people say it. And if people say it,
you're the most stylish.
What other barometer is there if people say that?
You're the most stylish.
I don't think that's true.
Okay.
I love clothes, but, you know...
So
I'm not pretending to know what I'm doing.
Oh yeah, okay. I should have just taken that compliment.
Yeah, you just take the compliment.
Excuse me. Yeah, that was actually not cool the way that I batted that way like that.
There was a conversation we had once with the band, and it was like you were advising Dan what to wear, and you said that. you know, some people consider me to be somewhat of a fashion expert. I don't know if you've seen. and then that's what gave you the launch pad to advise Dan.
Yeah.
He didn't fucking listen to you, and he should, really. He should.
Yeah.
You know.
Dan and Rue can afford to be fashion blind because they're square jawed, kind of handsome, kind of.
Whereas we're the sort of ratty, we're the ratty ones.
We're more emotional and.
We're the poets, they're the warriors.
We're greedy.
What is that too?
Greedy for praise and
yeah,
recognition.
Affirmations. We don't get them because of our visages. You know, we don't get those. So we need to... And the other thing is, I think a compliment that's related to what you're wearing means more than a compliment about your face. Because what you're wearing is something that you've curated and a style that you've developed yourself.
Yeah.
It's about your personality and the way you express it. You know,
my French grandfather liked to wear nice clothes. I remember I've been looking at pictures of the way he dressed in the 70s, 80s. So if I did get it from anywhere, it would have been from him.
Mm.
But I guess it's not really a great example, given I'm just wearing this shirt I've worn for the last 15 years. It's probably just if you're skinny, I guess, in a way you're kind of designed like the high-end kind of models, you know, have that kind of skinny, kind of rakish thing that kind of looks good with clothes on and looks even better with clothes off.
Indeed. Okay, quick fire round. I'm going to make up some stupid questions.
Fashion related?
It can, well, one of them will be.
Yeah.
If you had an infinite amount of money and you could go to a watch store that had all of the watches in the world, have you ever looked at a watch and thought, that's the watch for me, I would like to have it, but it's too expensive?
That's a good question. A few years ago, I thought, I should have a watch. I'm in my 50s.
And now you got one. So what's this, a driving watch or something?
It was a present from a lovely person.
How do you see the...
And I like it because you can't read the time. You have to take a picture with your phone. So it takes quite a long time. If someone asks you the time, you have to take a picture and then pick up the picture and tell
them. Is it waterproof?
It's very small. Should I put it next to the camera?
Yeah.
Is it here?
Zoom in there. Isn't that a lovely timepiece?
And I like the fact it's almost like a bunker.
Yeah, it is a bit like that.
Yeah, it's like a bunker, like really high bunker. Security. It's almost like the time is so precious. It's a metaphor again.
Yeah. Time is so precious that... Just to check what time it is, you need to take a photograph of it.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost, what's that thing again, that information that the government has again? What's it called again?
The classified information.
Yeah, classified information. The time.
It's on a need to know basis, and so if you really need to know, you'll be prepared to take a picture of your watch.
This is a classified information watch. But being serious, the one that I looked at and I would want, and I couldn't really afford, was, and excuse me if I get the name wrong, Philip.
Patek Philippe.
Yeah, how do you say it again?
Patek Philippe.
Patek Philippe. Mm. I saw like a navy blue 70s one.
Oh, I know the one you're talking about.
It was just elegant.
Yeah, it's a color so elegant.
Because I don't suit those big chunky things.
Yeah, in the 70s they were much smaller and then the trend became really big. I don't like big watches either.
Yeah.
But so, they were actually like something like 35 millimetres across those old color travers. I know the exact one you mean because the case is a little bit like... oval, isn't it? It's an interesting shape.
You know something, it's when you look really hard for something, as you well know, things come to you, don't they?
Yeah.
You know that, being a songwriter and a lyricist, and and you're very good at that, and you've actually taught all of us the art of waiting for it to come to you.
I get scared though, when you do it on this writing trip here, like and the last one as well, like the first couple of days I got nothing. And I'm like, okay. And I know I'm supposed to wait, and I know it'll come, but it's like, it gets 2 or 3 days into a week session, and you think, I'm letting the guys down here, and then I have a day when it all comes out. You know?
Yeah, and in Scotland too, you know, it can get antsy. It's all part of the journey, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
And,
but having said that, do you believe, and this is another quick fire one, do you believe that songs are in the ether, or is it something that you construct using your psyche and all that?
It's something to do with that quote, isn't it?
Yeah.
Everything has something to do with that.
And so, let me ask you this then. If you write a song, is that something that the universe is making happen to you? Or are you making, are you really creating that, or is the universe giving it to you?
I think it's both. It's not giving or taking, isn't it? It's that thing that's in between.
But the universe is presenting an opportunity.
You're vibrating with it.
Are you though, or are you, or is it like the way dreams work, where they're supposed to be like an amalgamation of the previous day's experiences coupled with some other emotional stuff and some unresolved childhood trauma?
Yeah. Something I think to describe and talk about always sounds a bit silly.
It's
beyond words almost. It's more to do with like the animal, you know, when you look at a dog and, you know, the mystery, you know, the scent. Okay, I like the French expression, following your nose.
Mm.
And it's why we love dogs, you know, because dogs follow their nose and dogs sense mm-hmm. something. So I think it's to do with sensing things. And I'm not saying that because I practice that. Because it's just something that I really admire in other people, including yourself. And I'd like to be more like that myself.
Do you reckon... The reason why I wanted to ask that is because it's leading into this question. So if there is an element of a song being in the ether and then you being ready to accept it, is it possible that AI is basically a net that catches these songs that are in the ether?
No, I completely disagree with that. And coming back to something just hit me just now when you were saying that, Rick Rubin mentioned it actually. And he said, you have to remember it's not about you, it's not about yourself. So you have to forget yourself and lose yourself. So that could be why it takes a lot.
In the music, the moment you own it, you better never let it go. You only get one chance, do not miss the chance to blow. This opportunity comes once in a lifetime, you better use it. That Eminem song from 8 Mile.
Of course.
Could have one of those on. It would have been a hit then, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Honestly, Dre, great producer, but sometimes he misses the obvious stuff, doesn't he?
He does. Mm. Yeah, we're using that test, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
We used to do the bossa nova test, now we're doing the country test.
Yeah. So that is true, isn't it? Like in the olden days, we used to write a song and it would be like a rock and roll song. And then we'd say, can we play it in the bossa nova style? And it'd still sound good. Because you and I have a real affection for bossa nova.
We liked it because the first ever Darkness song was I Love You Five Times, wasn't it? There was actually 4 or 5 years before the band were signed.
And that song came about with me and you pissing around. I genuinely believe that all of the best stuff comes from pissing around.
I think you're right.
And there's something about...
losing yourself, forgetting yourself, because pissing around is the fastest, surefire way of forgetting yourself.
Let me tell you something else that I think. It's play.
Yeah.
In the same way that intimacy with someone you love is play.
Yeah.
Making music with people you love, it's play.
Yeah.
And all the things that are interesting and creative come from playing.
Yeah.
And that's why collaboration is important. And that's why, like, if you find the right people to work with, as we have, then it's always a joy because it's basically just fun. And that's how the best marriages and the best bands and the most any project that's creative or romantic with any longevity is because you're playing.
Yeah, and of course.
And I think that's, you know, when you're playing, that focuses you for a kickoff.
Yeah.
Because, like, think about when you're playing soccer, there's a ball. You don't give a fuck about the bills you've got to pay.
Yeah.
You don't care about the people that are shouting at you at the side to pass. You'll take your time and you'll fucking launch a searcher. Yeah. But you need the focus to do that. And nothing else in your life matters in that moment. And I think that's what play is. Play is just...
It's nice that you brought relationships into that too. Because you're right, it's the same principle applies everywhere. You know you're on to a winner with the partner when you can just rip the piss out of each other and ego goes out the window. You don't care, you're just ripping the piss out of each other because you know that you're both humans. You're like,
I go for a cliff run every day and I'm running up there, and the people I bump into the most up there is elderly couples holding hands, or they're sitting down having a picnic, or they're hiking, and that's not an easy thing to get up, you know. You have to go into beast mode to be able to run it. It's properly challenging. Yeah. And they're up there in their 80s holding hands, sitting on top of a cliff. It's fucking beautiful. And it's just like...
That's nice.
That's the dream.
Yeah.
That's the dream.
Yeah.
That'll be me and you one day, Frankie. Not in the same way exactly, but... It nearly is. That's what people think.
It's a magical spot. People like to say we're in Cornwall,
Yeah, we can say we're in Cornwall. I think when we go down swimming, I think that's what people think we are.
You think?
Yeah, I think they think we're romantically intertwined.
I wonder.
Yeah, we're
it's funny that strange thing that happened when it started a few years ago when people would say that we were brothers. It never happened in 17 previous years, and it just happened like a couple of years ago. It was probably just the moustache thing, wasn't it? It was when you cut your hair. It was when you cut your hair, because the long hair would make people think that you were Dan's brother.
Yeah. Well, now everyone thinks Dan's me.
Yeah.
And they think I'm the other one, unless they've been watching the YouTube, and then it's, you know it is.
Yeah.
Anyway, this has been absolutely brilliant. Thank you, Frankie Poulin.
It's a pleasure.
I'm going to do it. You want to join me for the a cappella again?
Let's do it.
Do it straight down the barrel.
Justin Hawkins writes again.
I've done the same thing. I've done unison.
Yeah, lovely.
I always end up in unison.
You're holding a nice sort of
why do I always end up in unison? Starting my fucking life, man.
I think you sound a bit Ebber when you do that.
Unison Charlie, yeah? Oh, really?
Again. Nice one.
Thank you so much for listening. If you want to stay up to date on everything that I'm doing, you can join my mailing list, and there's a link in the description. Meanwhile, I'll see you next Monday for another episode of Justin Hawkins Rides Again, the podcast. Again.